Hi there, and welcome back to Hugo's There 2.0, and this is another regular guest pick episode where my guest chose the title, and this time the book is Declare by Tim Powers, which was a World Fantasy Award winner in 2001, and I think it was also a finalist for the 2002 Nebula Award. My guest for this is returning guest Paul Williams, and he previously joined me for a discussion on The City and the City, back in the old Hugo's There 1.0 days. So, Paul, I think the appropriate greeting is, are you constant to the old covenant?
Return and we return.
Yes, keep faith and so will we. So, anyhow, this book involves some spy stuff, and that's a code phrase that's repeated several times in the book. And so we'll talk about that. But first, Paul, anything new with you? I think last time we spoke, you were working on a doctorate?
Yeah, I am at the end of my doctorate. I am. I've been revising my dissertation daily, and I have to finish fast because I start a new job at Western Colorado University in August. So,
okay,
better get the day in care of. But I'm currently at Idaho State University, just wrapping up the PhD before I move a bit east.
Nice. Yeah, my son and I recently drove through all of that area. We drove up from Austin by way of Colorado and Utah and Idaho.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, let's go ahead and dive into it. In Hugo's There 2.0, I want to be a little lighter on the non-spoilers, meaning like, let's get to the point. And so let's talk about in the non-spoiler section, you know, why this book?
Yeah. So Powers is an author who's really intrigued me for a long time. He's one of only five authors to win the World Fantasy Award for Best Novel twice. Hmm. So he won first for Last Call, and I think that's 93, I want to say, and then Declare, which tied with Galveston by Sean Stewart, which is a tragically underread novel, in 2001. So a couple years ago, I read The Anubis Gates, which is, for many people, that's the gateway into Tim Powers. Hmm. Pun not intended, right. But it still works well.
Works with the title.
It does. I'm actually one of the few people for whom Anubis Gates didn't work very well. I felt that it was a lot of cool ideas, but I just did not give any number of craps about the main character in the Anubis Gates. But Declare for me was a huge improvement. I really got interested in Declare a few years ago. My best friend was really getting into spy fiction, and I'd heard about this one, so I got it for him for his birthday, and he's been begging me to read it for about 2 years now.
Okay. So you got it for somebody else, just knowing sort of what kind of book it was, but you hadn't ever read it before. This is the first time read for you?
Yes.
Okay. I don't think I knew that. So let's talk a little bit about what the book is, because it wears a few different hats. It has the secret history angle to it. It has the, I saw someone describe it as tradecraft meets Lovecraft. It kind of falls into weird fiction just a little bit as well, I think. Not maybe quite as much as something like The City and the City. But yeah, what if you wanted to describe this book to someone, how would you do that? How would you sell it to them?
Probably on the grounds that I've spent the entire time I was reading this book trying to think of comps for the, like, what are other books like this book? And I cannot think of anything that is like Declare.
Yeah.
It has secret history is definitely my starting point for this one. Maybe that's because my specialization is historical fictions, and mixes with genres. So, I'm very interested in that aspect, but I think also it is spy thriller meets Lovecraft meets Catholic novel. Weirdly enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know of any one way to describe this novel other than crazy awesome. Like, it's one of those books that manages to be really exciting, but also really smart.
Yeah, and so I was talking to somebody about this year's Hugo nominees, and spoilers for my thoughts on one of the books in particular, Starter Villain by John Scalzi. Right? I like John Scalzi. I don't feel like his last two Hugo nominees were worthy nominees. I feel like they're just fine popcorn books. And I was trying to explain this, and I'm like, for an award winner, I want something ambitious. And the counterexample I used was, think about Declare. Like, try and describe what this book is and how it's accomplished. It's so ambitious. And of course, you can have the other side of things, right? Where something is super ambitious, not very well executed. And there is one of those on the list this year as well. I'm not going to spoil that. And I'm not even sure it's not necessarily well executed. It's just not for me. But I applaud the ambition. And I'm always going to rank that over something that's well executed, but didn't have much to it. But Declare is definitely one of the ones that is ambitious and executes.
Yeah, I would agree. I think in some ways, maybe a way of, in my mind, at least the way I'm kind of differentiating what you're saying is, one is kind of like pick a typical MCU film, the first Thor movie, for instance. Like, it's a lot of fun. It's great. It's awesome. I love that movie.
So
yeah, everyone should. But then Declare is like The Dark Knight, where it's like, this is a comic book movie. It's also like one of the greatest movies I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, yeah. So in terms of what the book actually is, right, this is, it's a World War II kind of Cold War era spy novel.
Yeah.
But the backdrop of the spy novel is that the great game going on between the United States and the USSR, you know, the West and the Soviet bloc.
Britain and the USSR.
Yes. Yes, it is Britain. That's right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
My bad. Sorry. America-centric, I suppose. Is that there is something else behind the scenes that's driving all of this. And I just want to talk about the very beginning of the book. The prologue set such a great mood for it that I was like, ooh, I'm going to like this. Because it starts with this mysterious thing. Something's going on. Something has gone really badly. And there's this quote. He was fairly sure that 9 men had fled down the path an hour ago. Desperately, he hoped that as many as 4 of them might be survivors of the SAS group he had led up the gorge, and that they might somehow still be sane.
Yeah, super ominous. So back at Christmas time, my best friend's brother read Declare before I did, and he was hyping it. It was his favorite book that he read last year. And after he hyped it up, and my best friend had been hyping it for a year or a couple years at that point, sometimes when I'm going to bed, I get on Audible and I just play a sample of a random book. And I played the sample to Declare one night, and it did not help me go to sleep. It's like, I want more now, please.
And I mean, I think the book is told in a nonlinear fashion, and it's very effective because it kind of keeps you sort of in the dark a little bit, because it jumps from that prologue to, like, I don't know, 1963, something like that. It's been like 20 years. And the main character, Andrew Hale, who was you know, part of this spy agency, British spy agency, has periodically sort of been soft recalled, but then nothing's ever come of it. And not nothing, right? He did go out in 1948 after the war, and some interesting stuff happened then. But now it's almost 20 years later, and they're trying to come to the end of this Operation Declare, right? And that's one thing I wanted to talk about, was the dual meaning of the title, because you have that operation as well as you have the kind of card, the gambling game, high or low, right? Assemble your cards, and then you have to declare if you want to play for the best hand or the worst hand. That was interesting.
Well, yeah, there's also that biblical level that refers to, like, pitting mortal will against divine will as well.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, there's the epigraph of the whole novel that has that reference from the book of Job about kind of the challenge from God to man about if you know more about how the world and the cosmos works, then declare that knowledge and assert that position in the world. And it's very much this, you know, kind of a very brisk way of putting it would be kind of a know your place. I think that's probably, as believers, you and I probably have a much more complicated and nuanced view of that. But I think that a very surface reading would suggest that there's kind of this sense of recognizing man's insignificance in the world.
Yeah. It's the cosmic, do you know who I am?
Exactly.
Yeah. I definitely do want to talk about the cosmology of this book.
Yes. But
let's save that for spoilers.
Agreed.
In fact, I'm trying to think if there's anything else. I mean, like we mentioned, it's nonlinear. It's a spy novel. If you like spy novels, this is a terrific spy novel just on its face, right? It has the really interesting cosmological spiritual things going on as well that can bring in a fantasy fan. So it's a really nice mashup of the two. If that's something that you're into, then I think you're really going to enjoy this book.
I would agree. And just some fascinating games of history. In fact, it might be worth talking about really fast Powers' methodology of storytelling.
Yeah, go for it.
And this is something that, I mean, he actually has an end note in this particular volume. But if you there are several videos with Powers available on YouTube, and he always shares this, that his approach is he'll come across just an oddity or a gap in history. Just well, he's just reading for fun, and it gets him thinking. And so in this case, he found out about all these just odd things in the care in the historical character of Kim Philby, this British intelligence officer who was a Soviet spy for decades, and ended up just it really screwed up British intelligence for a long time. In fact, it's Philby who outed John le Carré and the author of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, and Graham Greene actually were both intelligence officers who were outed by Kim Philby.
Wow.
And amongst others. And but he found out that Philby had this fox, this pet fox that died, and he cried for 2 days. He's like, we know that Kim Philby was at Mount Ararat on this day. Why? We don't know. He was there though. And so what he does is he just looks at, okay, here are all these weird little nodes in the historical chronicle. And he's very clear, he's very rigid, I should say, that he doesn't change history. If we have a date for it, or if we know if it was a factual event, it happens in his world.
Right.
But he's trying to find what is a fantastical super narrative that can thread all these things together and can explain all these things. And that's true for others of his novels as well. But this one is, I think, probably the most, it's widely considered his most rigorously researched and tightly bound novel in that respect.
Yeah. And the other, you know, connection with Kim Philby is all the other epigraphs that are from Rudyard Kipling's Kim, which I have not read. I wondered if it would enhance this, because it's very much about the great game, right?
Yeah, that's my understanding.
Yeah.
And it's worth noting, like, another oddity about Powers is, here's a guy, like, again, you listen to his interviews on YouTube, and he's very very much a pulp-minded individual. Like, he says he doesn't read a lot of fiction these days, but he'll always talk about just the influence of Heinlein, Lovecraft, authors who not just are genre, but have a very specific sensibility of genre. Mm-hmm. And yet Powers' work is always drenched in what people might often consider like capital L highbrow literature. I mean, we begin with the prologue has an epigraph from The Prelude by William Wordsworth. Mm. We've got references to the Bible. One of the faculty in my department, he specializes in British lyric poetry. And I asked him, I was like, hey, do you know much about J.K. Stevens, who provides another epigraph? And he's like, I don't. I'm like, if you don't know much about J.K. Stevens, how on earth does Tim Powers know anything about J.K. Stevens? And characters are always talking in references to poetry and books, and yet you believe it. And it's just the weirdest, or maybe not weirdest, but it's certainly a very unexpected amalgam of things to be found in one book.
Yeah, yeah. And the other fun part for me, for somebody who grew up, you know, and experienced the fall of the Soviet Union, and I was studying German in high school when the Berlin Wall came down.
Oh wow!
And my teacher was from Berlin and had escaped from East Berlin right before the wall went up, and you know her family was left behind, you know, so like I'm very connected to that whole era. But thinking about the Cold War, right? You have so many if you go back to the golden era of science fiction, you have so many things that just extend the status quo into the future and just assume, well, the Soviet Union's always going to be a thing, right? You even look at 2001, Space Odyssey, right? There's still the Cold War going on in that. And I think it was hard for someone to imagine that things would change as drastically as they did. And that's what's fun about a book like this that kind of answers that question. Well, how could this have happened? You know, there's not a material explanation for it. Of course, there are all kinds of economic and you know, Chernobyl and other things that were happening that led to the fall of the Soviet Union. But I like this as kind of like, maybe I can fill in the cracks here and say, well, maybe it was this though.
That's an excellent point, actually.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, I think we should just go ahead and get right over into spoilers. I think we've been somewhat vague. But yeah, let's talk about it. What would you like to start with? I want to talk about the cosmology of the book, but we can talk about other stuff as well.
Actually, let's start with cosmology. I think that because the novel is told non-linearly, it's useful to have a big picture idea.
Yeah. Yeah. So some of the backdrop of this novel kind of fits into some work that I've been reading up on recently about stuff like the Divine Council in the Hebrew Bible.
Oh, okay.
Where the idea that the writers of the Hebrew Bible were not monotheists in the same way that we are, and the ancient Israelites were not monotheists in the same way that American Christians are, that Christians are in general, or even that modern Jews are. And instead, they believed in this divine council where there was this whole, not pantheon, but there were these lesser deities, essentially, lesser powers that were all under the authority of Yahweh, of the one God, right? And so you see stuff like that with like the Tower of Babel and like the need for the flood and the Nephilim and all of that. It all ties in and explains a lot of really weird passages in the Hebrew Bible that if you, most of the time we just go, we look at them and go, that's weird. Let's move on. Right.
Yeah.
And it's fun to dig into some of that stuff. But here, you know, you have in Islam in particular, right, you have the idea of jinn. Or maybe it's just in the Middle East. I'm not sure if it's specifically from Islam.
Kind of both is my understanding.
Yeah. And so this book kind of ties in that there's these, I think in a New Testament sense, we think of them as principalities and powers, right?
Yeah.
In the writings of Paul.
Yeah.
And that they have influence in the world, and that explains some of the what's going on in terms of who's in power, who stays in power, especially who stays in power.
No, I agree. And so here we have this idea, right, that there's these creatures, eldritch creatures, that get referred to mostly as jinn throughout the series, throughout the novel, but also might be angels or something like that. And it wasn't clear to me that this time through, maybe on reread, this will become a bit clearer as to whether or not it's like, is Ararat just this, like, is there like a nexus there that they can come through, or, where exactly they're coming from, but they certainly are, they get linked to physical spaces in ways.
Mm-hmm.
And the Russians have back in the 1880s, hijacked one of these and took it back to Russia, and they call it Machika.
Which, right. Mistress of Misfortune.
Yeah. Which also, you know, it sounds like Magica or magic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Nice little bit of punnage there on Power's part.
And then he uses that to talk about stuff like, it reminds me a little bit of The Cabin in the Woods. I don't know if you ever saw that movie.
No.
Oh, okay. There's an elder gods kind of aspect to that where like the tropes of people being slaughtered, you know, in a slasher movie are to appease these elder gods. It's very funny. It's very meta. I don't really love horror movies, but that one's worth watching.
Just
for that part of it, it'll remind you of Declare just a little bit, because this book talks about how, you know, some of the pogroms, some of the worst, you know, slaughters of millions of people under Stalin and other successors, you know, well, maybe that was to appease the bloodlust of this mistress of misfortune who was keeping them in power.
And I like the way that it's such a different approach to fantasy in general, right?
Yeah.
Usually fantasy is deeply ground into the story world, and either one, it's very well known in characters are acquainted with it. That's like Dungeons and Dragons and things like that. Mm-hmm. Or it's very rare, like in Lord of the Rings. Like, yeah, like we know this is a thing, but there's like five wizards in the whole world. Oh, well. Or like there's like the video game approach where you just got to level up and you master it. But with Powers, he talks a lot about, in his interviews, he talks about how like he himself doesn't really believe in these things, and yet he also kind of does. Like an example he'll use is when he was writing Last Call, which deals with the tarot, he bought a tarot deck in order to have pictures to reference, but he refuses to shuffle it. He says, like, I don't believe in it exactly, but I also don't know what's on the other end at the same time.
Right.
And for him, magic is something that humans don't wield. It is not something to be controlled or manipulated. It is always something exacting and dangerous, which you don't see very often, particularly in current fantasy.
Yeah, that reminds me of, have you watched Ted Lasso?
I love Ted Lasso.
Yeah, so when they, you know, they think they're ghosts, you know, that the treatment room is cursed.
And, oh, yeah. And
Roy Kent's like, I don't believe it, you know. And it's like, all right, you and I are going to go in there. No. No, I don't believe it, but I'm not going in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, just a healthy humility, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So for anybody, I know there are people out there who, you know, have no idea what's Mount Ararat. What does this have anything to do with? And so for anybody who doesn't know that, in the Hebrew Bible, that's where the resting place of Noah's Ark. And it's fun because he brings that into this book, and everybody is just sort of credulously saying, well, that's Noah's Ark there. And then they get there and they find out, oh, no, that's not actually the Ark. It's something different. And that as the waters receded, it would have, you know, it would have gone down further. It wouldn't have just stuck on the top of that mountain.
Yeah. And it relieves hail too.
What's that?
And hail's relieved by it too.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I definitely want to talk about the religious aspects of this as well, because some of the stuff about you're interacting with this stuff and you still see you're an atheist reminds me of Indiana Jones a little bit.
Yeah. But
yeah, the idea that somehow these principalities and powers that were supposed to be wiped out in the flood were kind of hooky-bobbed on the back of the Ark, you know, like rode a skateboard behind it like Marty McFly, and then ended up in this spot on Ararat. And this mission, this declared mission, was to go and do something. And that's part of the question of what exactly were they trying to do? And then there's all kinds of other stuff about, well, if we wanted to destroy these things, how do we do it?
Yeah. And so these jinn angels, whatever they are, the one thing they've managed to figure out with 20th century science and logic is, oh, these things exist in a certain temporal sense, like what they think is active material impact. And so if they believe they exist, then they exist. And that's kind of their thing. And so you got to find a way to convince it that it's dead.
Yes. Yeah. You show it an image of death and it will take that on board and go, oh, I'm dead now.
Yeah.
I like too that like it is approached almost like a science where they're like, okay, we have these, what do they call them? Shehab meteorites.
Think that's it.
You know, that have fallen in these various places and like destroyed whole cities.
Yeah.
And they find, okay, there's these concavities in these, and these are the markers of death, right? And then they find out, no, it's not the concavity of it. Those marks were made by these convex structures.
Yeah.
And so you need that. You need something egg-shaped, but with a cross on it, you know, then the ankhs and all the other stuff. It's it's fascinating. That's why I think, you know, a reread would be really fun, kind of knowing what I know now.
Well, and that does kind of draw us to the temporal structure of the novel, because I think this was a really fascinating impact. I don't know how this plays on the audio, but for me, there was always this element of either something gets mentioned. Oh, okay, so backing up. So you're vacillating throughout the whole novel between 1943, 1945, 48, 63. Like those are kind of the four times we are waffling betwixt. Mm-hmm. And a huge chunk of it is in 43, and a smaller chunk of it is in 48, and then a lot of it's in 63. And then 45 is mildly there. And something will get mentioned as like, wait a second, I don't know what you're talking about there. And then usually either the end of the chapter or the next chapter, it gets, it's very much a sense of you are told the conclusion of it before the actual event, which I do want, maybe that's supposed to kind of emulate the way the jinn experience time. I don't know.
I'm thinking, is that emblematic of something like I think it was the Shehab meteorites, right? Where they talk about the stone that they hauled up to Ararat in 43. Yeah. And they had plans for it. They were going to, I think, blow it up. And
yes.
And that was going to take care of those principalities. And there's almost a metaphor here for like mutually assured destruction, right?
Yeah.
We're going to blow this up so that the Russians can't get it.
Yeah.
And you know, we're not going to use it to our own ends. We just want to take it out of play.
And so, but it was just fascinating to me how the novel kind of disrupts its own surprises, and yet they're still surprising when they happen. like that. And I think that's part of why this is I love a story that it doesn't matter if you know beforehand what it's about, because there is something about the experience of the text.
Yeah.
And this novel does this to you over and over again, where it tells you an end result and then leads you through it. And because mm-hmm. you've gone through that process, that end result takes on a meaning that it could not have if you were just told about it beforehand.
Yeah. Yeah. And it kind of tells and retells stuff too, right?
Yes.
It further contextualizes stuff about relationships, because we haven't even talked about most of the characters, right? We mentioned Kim Philby. We mentioned Andrew Hale. We have not talked about Elena, and I don't have her full name written down, but it's
Elena Saniza Bendiga.
Yes.
So in Anubis Gates, I need to go back farther than that. So when Tim Powers and James Blaylock were friends in grad school, they felt that the campus literary journal was publishing dumb crap. And so they sat down together and they took turns. One of them would write a line of a poem, and the goal was to be as pretentious as possible. And then the next one would write a line, and they just went back and forth. And they felt, you know, it sounds florid and pretentious enough, why not? And they kept getting it published. And so they invented the name of a poet, William Ashbless.
Her name means something like that, right?
Her name means ashes of blessing, basically.
Right.
And so in the Anubis Gates, Powers has there's some time travel, go back to the early 19th century, and you're supposed to meet the poet William Ashbless, and that's a big thing in the Anubis Gates. And then it turns out that Blaylock also mentions William Ashbless, or has William Ashbless appear in his novel that they were submitted to the same editor the same year. And the editor was like, "Do you guys know each other?" "Yeah, we do." "Oh, we'll change it." No. "Keep it." And they're like, "But one book is set in 1810 and one set in the 1950s. "Well, you guys can figure that out." And as a result, Powers has said that every novel since Anubis Gates, he tries to fit some sort of reference to Ashbless as, he says, a good luck charm.
Mm, that's fun.
Yeah. So that's where Elena Saniza Bendiga comes from.
Okay. Excellent. And she's kind of the femme fatale. And you go through like all the stuff with Hale where he has to have a cover and like a cover of his cover, because he's kind of working as a double agent, right? They're trying to make it plausible that he is going to go to the other side. And so, get arrested going to a communist meeting, establish your bona fides for that. And we'll paper over everything so you can still have a career after this.
And we'll arrest you first, but...
Exactly. Right. But there's also, you know, how committed are you, right? The would you kill your brother, right? And which, of course, that's like the main thing that the book really deals with. And on a reread, I'd really like to dig into some of that stuff, because I felt like some of the not quite twins thing that was going on there didn't totally sink in. I think I could get that on a reread. But you have that, you know, that's how he comes across Elena at first, and then he keeps encountering her over time.
Yeah, and she initially is like mentor to Hale. Mm-hmm. And she, you know, the things that she mostly teaches him are the trade craft of being a spy.
Yeah.
But the thing that she most wants to teach him is how to be a good communist.
Right.
Because she's a very orthodox communist. She was a child during the Franco Revolution in Spain. And so she has great animosity towards fascism, definitely, and the failures of Western democracy to protect itself. And so for her, communism is the solution, right?
Right.
But of course, she undergoes her own character arc with that regard throughout.
Right, because she's also quite burned by Catholicism, right? She feels like it was Catholics who killed her parents.
Yeah. Yeah. So she's very frustrated with everything Western. And so she embraces communism, but then she finds that, oh, communism can't really be trusted. And I think maybe what's interesting about Hale and Elena specifically is the way that I think there's a lot of the sense of arriving at a sort of transcendental self-knowledge of the divine for both of them. Like Elena, she out of absolute unquestionable and unwavering loyalty returns to Moscow. Return to Moscow is the one of the code terms for basically go back for voluntary execution.
Right.
And instead she's tortured and it's this whole horrifying thing. She's the one who kind of finds the details about this djinn, this angel, whatever it is that the Russians have. Mm-hmm. And yet, in that moment is where she just digs into herself and she finds this sense of faith, this dedication to God, or rather to the Virgin Mary, honestly. And Hale kind of comes along a similar trajectory. And like, there's something really powerful about the moment in the epilogue when Hale plays the cards with Philby, and he just kind of walks away and is that very like just strong, self-composed thing. And in both of them, I think, because one of the motifs throughout is the walking pattern that Elena teaches him in Paris. There's this way that Elena teaches him to walk, which I always kept thinking about the sand walking in Dune every time.
Exactly. Yeah, me too.
But it's this way of walking that just apparently is supposed to make you seem innocuous. And it's, you know, back to the idea of how these djinn, angels, principalities, whatever they are, work, is the sense of attunement to a metaphysical dimension, right? Mm-hmm. Like getting attuned to something that is outside of typical material experience, but actually impacts that at the same time. Yeah. And so like in this way, faith is less about a conviction and more a sense of being, as it were.
And you have other times where there's that horrifying scene in the Ahura Gorge. Where this is kind of when, I think this is in 48, where they're going back to Mount Ararat to complete the mission, right?
Yeah.
And it all goes very poorly. And Hale tries to pull out his Ankh to like diffuse the situation. It just gets ripped out of his hand. And to keep himself from being consumed, he starts tapping out a pattern, right? And it reminds me of the walking, right? And something about that pattern disrupts things. Yeah. But then he finds himself in almost sympathetic harmony with the djinn as they're consuming the rest of the people who have gone up there with them.
And well, that's exactly it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's he taps on, he's using the trigger of his gun to tap out the same rhythm as the walking thing is. And that aligns him, or brings him in sympathy with the djinn. And so he kind of like merges into this kind of collective consciousness of the djinn. But the cost of that is that not only does he get survivor's guilt, but he gets to experience what it's like to devour his cohort through the djinn's mouth.
Yeah. Yeah. I was literally rereading that one right before I came up. Just because it was chilling.
It was. Well, and it's so sudden. Another thing about Powers, right, is he doesn't do the typical, and now we're going to do the quest thing. Oh, no, the quest thing has gone wrong. Here's how it's gone wrong. It's just, oh, no, it's suddenly going wrong.
Yeah.
What the heck happened? Oh, that's right, because Kim Philby betrayed them. They told us that back in Chapter 3, but I forgot they said that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's the effective thing of the shifting time, right? You're like, what happened in 48? Yeah. You know, and like, how did you get to that point? Interesting. And then that's offset with, of course, the ultimate kind of fulfillment of the mission in 63, where there's more than one side of this, where like there's all of it kind of gelled together, the supernatural stuff and the actual Cold War expediency of the spy craft, right? Where, okay, you need to shoot Kim Philby in the back with this, you know, with birdshot from a 410, which I don't know if you've ever shot a 410. It's a tiny little, it looks like a toy. Mm. And like, I think one time we went to my in-law's place down in Southern Oregon with some friends. He had a whole bunch of guns and he brought them all along. And he also worked in IT. And so the other thing he brought were targets, and what they were hard drive plates. So they just look like these shiny discs that we put up on the hillside to shoot. And we went up point blank range with a 410 and shot one of the hard drive plates, which are metal, but the bird shot just barely dented the metal. Like it tickled it. Not that it's not dangerous. Don't play with a 410. It's, you know, it's called bird shot. It can kill a bird. But not the kind of stuff that's going to be necessarily a life threatening to a human. But the idea, sorry, that was a bit of a digression, is to shoot Kim with that. And then he goes back to the Soviet Union, dies as a hero, is buried. And in him now, he has these pellets that have that marker of death on them, so that the Mistress of, what was it, Mistress of Mayhem? Misfortune. We'll see those and die, right? And the Soviet Union will collapse.
Yeah, really just amazing how wide the net of this novel is and yet how tightly it pulls. And it doesn't feel like it was, I remember I was reading, it's one of the, you know, it's the last chapter before we begin the climax, as it were. And basically it's the final exposition dump. And mm-hmm. it's the one time it's when it's, you know, heart sick. We never met this guy before, but suddenly he's like this wealth of exposition and tells us everything. Mm-hmm. And I was hanging on to every word of that chapter. It's, yeah. and it's like, you know, by the way, Kim Philby is your brother. Wait, what? Like, normally I would be really incredulous about that because I'd be like, no, you did not. But no, here I totally believed it. Mm-hmm. Cause there's the one faint early, when they first recommission Hale in chapter, I want to say 3 or something like that. And, one of them mentions that he looks like Lawrence, T.E. Lawrence.
Right.
And I was like, okay, that's too obvious. Obviously the whole heritage thing is going to be important, but it never occurred to me to consider that Andrew Hale might be Kim Philby's long lost brother, let alone the implications of, so Kim Philby was actually born in a certain circumstance that means that he actually has, he can like split himself like an X-Men character. But then right. when you were born as Kim Philby's half brother, you kind of replaced his duplicate self and you're now linked together. It's like, naturally, okay. of course.
As one does.
I swear this would make a great Christopher Nolan film. Like I kept thinking that's why I would want to adapt this novel as Christopher Nolan. It has the exact same non-linearity that he loves to do and the ability to just going to exposit really suddenly, carry on.
Yeah. There's the other side of the, what is it called? The, I've got it written down here someplace. Oh yeah. Amomon root.
Yeah.
That it's something that sprouts in, you know, wherever the djinn dies, then these roots spring up and they can confer some kind of immortality.
Yeah.
And that becomes important for the final kind of confrontation between Kim and Andrew.
Yeah. I confess, like I did not catch on to the, Amomon roots until the epilogue.
Me neither. Yeah. Not at all. I had to go back and I searched on my Kindle. I searched for that word and went back and looked and like, okay, they did set this up. I just missed it.
Yeah. I remember them talking about it, but I never grasped onto what their significance was. I was like, that's just one of those things I'm going to take on faith and hopefully it makes sense later on. Mm-hmm. And it does, like it works like, oh, that's where they come from. And that's the effect. And the way that the novel does resolve with the question about, assured immortality versus the prospect of love. And, but then, and I am not a Catholic. I actually have a friend who's a devout Catholic. And so I was constantly texting him throughout this book. Like, can you explain this to me? Explain this to me as well. which, he asks me about Mormonism for, as he reads Orson Scott Card. And so we're even now. And, but as I understand, you know, Catholicism, like there is this element, you know, I mean, the argument to be made for how love is the thing that makes eternal life worthwhile.
Right.
And, you know, if God is love and if God is the source of eternal life, then everything else, you know, this kind of makes the, Amomon roots kind of a Tower of Babel thing, right? It's a man made or it's a man harnessed effort to achieve godhood without doing things God's way. Again, back to that issue of declare from Job, right? Like, know your place. Like, there's a pathway for you, but you got to do it my way. Got to play by my rules here, people.
Yeah, it reminds me of the apples in the garden in The Magician's Nephew, if you remember from the,
it's been a
the
long Chronicles time, of Narnia, but,
where the White Queen goes there. And, you know, if you take an apple from there licitly, then it will, you know, provide healing and even immortality. The queen climbs over the wall and gets them. And you know, the children say to Aslan, well, you know, it won't work, right? And he says, no, all things work as they're intended, but she'll find that immortality is bitter.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I think Kim is looking at. And additionally, with the shot that he still has under his skin is going to nullify essentially the effect of those roots.
Yeah. It also kind of, you know, brings us to the point that one of the repeated phrases in the novel is from Genesis about I heard thy voice and hid myself because I was naked.
Yes.
Which is what Adam says to God in the Garden of Eden after he's partaken of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And so there might also be something like I'm realizing just in this moment, there might be a connection between contrived immortality and the constant repetition of that particular phrase.
Well, I think it absolutely ties into the stuff that you have with the king of Wahab.
I think it's Wahab.
Yeah. Where, you know, he says he's a son of a fallen angel and a woman. Right. And says, you know, I will not face judgment because I'm immortal. You know, it's only mortals who face judgment. And Kim has, or Philby has kind of maintained an atheism in the face of all this obvious supernatural stuff. And his thinking kind of seems to be, you know, well, as long as I'm immortal, you know, I don't have to face that. Where both Andrew and Elena have come back to their faith through all of this.
That's a really good point. I don't have anything clever to add to that.
And you know, it reminds me a little bit of Indiana Jones, where you're like, how are you not a believer now at this point?
Yeah.
You know, you saw the Ark of the Covenant, you healed your father with the Holy Grail. Seems like maybe maybe he'd still be like, well, it's probably aliens.
Yeah. Well, I think that's, part of that ambiguity in this novel is that, right? It's that the characters suggest maybe these are angels, the fallen angels of some sort, but we don't know. And, we're going to call them jinn. And, jinn are mentioned in the Quran as a creation of God. Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. But there, it's like everything requires, this entire cosmology is very dependent upon a plural textual explanation. Like it's like, okay, there's certainly some biblical stuff here, but we were also including Arabian Nights. We're including, just raw history. We're including some quantum theory as well. Like there's all kinds of things that are being layered in there, and no single epistemology can account for everything.
Mm. Yeah. I guess we've been talking about the faith aspect of it. Anything else you want to talk about that?
I think one more thing I kept thinking about in regard to, like, maybe less about the faith, but more so this idea of just angels in a text that certainly isn't devotional. One novel I thought of as a potential comp, but in a very weird way for this one, is The Translator by John Crowley, which is not as exciting, but really wonderful novel. I'm a big John Crowley fan. But in that novel, so that is also a Cold War set novel. It's about a Russian poet who modeled off of Brodsky, who flees to the United States, becomes a college professor, this guy Phelan gets involved with a student who becomes his translator, and their relationship isn't really sexual. It's very intellectual and romantic and without the sex part. But then by the end, there's it draws upon, I can't remember, there was a early 20th century Russian philosopher who's proposed this model that every nation has two guardian angels, a greater angel, which is like military power, and the lesser angel, which is cultural power. And those two forces being the things that nations put against each other. Mm. And just the way that it's, and The Translator was published in 2002. So you have two novels very close to each other. It made me think about some scholarship that talks about just the role of angels in American fiction of the 1990s.
Mm. It actually reminds me a little bit of the Space Trilogy by C.S. Lewis, where there's like almost an angelic force that guards over each world.
Oh, okay.
And where on some of the worlds they've been basically chased out.
Oh, interesting.
That's the Space Trilogy is on my list to revisit for the podcast. So one of these times I'm going to have to dig those out again and reread them.
Yeah, those are. I don't have the stomach for Narnia, but those are on my list.
Yeah. Let's see. So, I did want to talk a little bit more about the spy part as well, because right at the top we talked about some of the code phrases, and the book does such a good job. Powers does such a good job of initiating you into the spy craft of it a little bit.
Yeah.
Where he says, you know, bless me, right?
Yeah.
And that means things are not what they seem. You know, pay attention. And all these other things about, you know, now we're into total evasion procedures, right? We've hit that moment and we're doing that. And just such a good job with the repetition throughout the different time periods.
Yeah.
Where by the end of the novel, somebody says, bless me. And you're like, oh, what's going on? Something's not what it seems.
Yeah, you jump.
Yeah.
No, yeah, I agree. And he really teaches you how to be suspicious of the characters, but to also be trusting the text at the same time.
Yeah.
Because, like I said, he's very clever, or not clever, he's very mindful to use repetition, because I always hate it when a text drops something one time and you're just expected to hold on to that knowledge.
Right.
And in a book that's going to yank you around in time as much as this one does, it's very generous of him to use repetition like that. But in the process, he's teaching you to watch out for these things, and they train you to have responses to it. And sometimes you're also kind of, you want to poke the character and say, hey, come on, say the thing, say it now.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which is a lot of fun.
And, you know, some of that stuff, I feel like we talked about, like with the roots, right? The Rafik diamond, right? There's some things that are dropped kind of once or twice, and then you have to go, have we talked about this before? And it's just, it was lost in a sea of other things, right? And so I feel like it's more successful with a lot of the spycraft stuff, and maybe a little less successful with the others. I'm not really going to ding the book for that, because it is the kind of stuff where it makes you want to go back and like, oh, I guess I need to reread that chapter.
Yeah, absolutely.
Some of the other just uses of phrases, like establishing the truth about someone, means essentially eliminating them.
Yeah. There's a lot of interesting wordplay, I think, throughout. Some of it's very deceptive. Like, you just get blasted with so many different organization acronyms. It's just like, okay, SES and SIS and SEO. I think we're on the SIS side of things right now, so sure. And that kind of, you know, that helps you kind of respect Hale's ability to keep track of things. And yet, I never felt really completely, it's like, in some ways, some of like NKVD, like that was like, oh yeah, so I know that I'm in an earlier time frame of the story, because NKVD is defunct after a certain point.
Right.
Or
now we're in the KGB era. Yeah.
Yeah. I really loved the ways that he used Kim Philby's stutter in humorous ways. My favorite one is, I couldn't hope to find it right now, but it's the one chapter from Kim Philby's perspective. And it says something like, he tells a woman, he's like, I need you to pretend that we're having a Mary Marshall marital affair. And I like that he's not just creating an effect, he's having some fun with it.
Yeah. So the I did this partly in print. I started it in print, and then I kind of switched over to audio, you know, while I was doing some stuff, like mowing my lawn or driving to work, that kind of stuff. And then would pick it back up in print and just kind of shift read it. That's what I call doing that. The audiobook narrator did a really nice job with the stuttering.
Oh, good.
There was one strange choice that happened, and I can't remember the name of the character. It's one of the ones, one of the American characters that dies at Ararat in 1948. It's like Flannery, or it's an Irish name, right? Okay. And for some reason, he did an Irish accent, and I'm like, but you just said he was American.
That is weird. So,
yeah. I thought that was a weird choice. Another thing was, there's a lot of descriptions of, or naming of, different calibers of guns.
Yeah.
And I don't feel like people who talk about guns would say a .45, you know, they just say a .45, right? Or a .4410, it's just a .410.
Yeah.
But it's the kind of stuff where I just feel like maybe that audiobook narrator Well, he wasn't American, so probably doesn't know much about guns. Unfortunately,
yeah, that's fair.
We do.
He probably pronounces it Sengen Philby, doesn't he?
Yes.
Yeah. I had to get halfway through a PhD before I knew that Sengen meant St. John.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I learned that back watching Airwolf as a kid. Because the main character's brother, who was like lost in Vietnam, was named Sengen.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
I also like some of the, just kind of throwing out more things that we liked about the book. Some of the early stuff, the interactions with, I've lost his name. Like the main contact at SIS.
Theodora,
that's right. Where he talks, Andrew Hale remembers Theodora from when he was a child. And interacting with him and being asked, tell me about your dreams on the new year. And it just does a good job of kind of establishing, oh, is there something special about Andrew? Because for a lot of the rest of the novel, he's not quite an everyman, you know, because he is quite competent in his in his spycraft and everything. And you know, he's not bumbling by any means. No. But, you know, the life that he went back into was, you know, kind of a humble college professor, humble lecturer, right? And so, but having those seeds there that, okay, there's something special about this guy. What is it? And you don't find out until later that it's the whole kind of separated twins thing.
Yeah. Well, and that was, I was constantly guessing because at first I was like, okay, so maybe it's just like some deal that his mom made to get herself out of Palestine with a newborn. As I say, it was just kind of like a Samuel the Boy Prophet thing where it's like, I'm just going to pledge my child to service to the crown.
Right.
And then it's like, okay, what about your dreams? And it's like, all right, well, that could mean anything, couldn't it? And then it's, you know, you look just like T.E. Lawrence. Mm-hmm. That's a red herring, it turns out. And then you just kind of forget for a while. It just seems to be, I guess, well, they've invested in this guy and they've trained him and he has been to Ararat, so we're going to do it. But yeah, then it's once you start to find out those things like, oh, so Hale is special. I mean, mostly I was just glad he was such an improvement over just what a loser the protagonist of Anubis Gates is.
Oh.
Other people love that novel. Many people love that novel, and I do like it, but it did not impress me the way it does other people. And a lot of it I blame at the feet of the protagonist. And so I was at a literature conference a few months ago, and I picked up Powers' novel, Stress of Her Regard, which has Nephilim in it, apparently. Back to that issue of like primordial entities. But someone else saw me with it. It's like, oh, that and Declare are my two favorites. Anubis Gates, screw it. But that one and Declare. I was like, well, I'm reading Declare in a month or two. And they're like, oh, you're so lucky. And yeah, so I'm looking forward to Stress of Her Regard. It seems that a lot of my previous apprehensions with Powers go back to just Doyle. Just that character Doyle is just such a lame protagonist.
Well, you're not selling me that book. So.
I'm being too hard on it. I really am. And I need to reread it, honestly.
And yet there's so many books out there to read.
Well, it's a Philip K. Dick Award winner, so I think that's on your list, isn't it?
Oh, it is on the list, yeah. All right. Yeah. Well, somebody else out there who wants to pick it up, let me know.
Yeah, I think it was the first Philip K. Dick winner, actually. Mm. Powers himself was actually friends with Philip K. Dick.
Okay. I don't know. I've kind of run out of my notes. I told you beforehand my notes are in almost complete disarray. Before we got on, I went through and quickly tried to categorize stuff, you know, like this is under the faith stuff and that's under the spy. And then, you know, the cosmology, I tried to group it, but, I've kind of run out, I think of things I'd written down.
Yeah. I think the only thing I would add just circling back is, you know, the way the novel, that idea of the sort of like cosmic harmonious resonance thing, the novel kind of does that because the novel is so fragmented and yet it lures you into understanding its whole shape by the end, and you don't know it inside and out and all the intricacies, but you have a good sense of it that I honestly look forward to rereading Declare in the not too distant future.
I did want to mention too the relationship between Hale and Elena, you know, is kind of sweet and innocent in some ways, right? Because like at some point they're like, oh yeah, we are married, aren't we? Somebody married us. And so it's okay that we're sleeping together, you know?
Yeah, classic
match. And I definitely do appreciate too that the author, you know, they do share a bed a couple of times, but Powers has no interest in describing anything that goes on. It's just mentioned that this happened. And I appreciate that.
Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting because, I mean, you know, this is from this is written at a time when the market still generally didn't expect male authors to work very hard at female characters. And I think there are some, there are some recognizable tropes at work in Elena, and yet there's something about Elena that feels very realized. And to your point about kind of the sweetness of it, like I remember the part when Hale just tells her straight up, my name is Andrew Hale. He completely casts off all the tradecraft for a minute. Mm-hmm. And I believe it, that he does feel about her this way.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and too, with the high low bet, the declare bet, you know, at the end, right? Well, I would have gone to her either way.
Yeah.
Like that's really all I care about, because I know what her birthday is, and I know she made a promise to be in this particular place, and I want to find her if I can.
I
thought that was very sweet. And she does fit roughly into the femme fatale kind of mold.
She does.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, my experience with femme fatales, right, is that they're usually pretty fully realized, and the fact that Elena has to figure herself out throughout the novel, even in we see less of it than other characters. Mm-hmm. And I guess, again, back to the idea of how Top Powers plays with history. I think Elena, the part when she's in Russia and they're, the way that he invokes, you know, we have this cosmology at work, and we have this sense of, well, here's like actual trade craft and spy work and stuff like that. We're also going to kind of throw in this some very interesting things. Like, we're going to invent this very bizarre hypnosis thing that I'm willing to bet probably is at least a theory that spy networks were trying to exercise at the time, where she has to like sit in a chair and they hypnotize her into believing that the person across from her is who she is. And then they shoot that person. So that way she thinks that she is dead. And it's kind of this like grotesque, perverse baptism, as it were. Mm. And, you know, the death of the old and the rebirth and as a true vessel of communism. And I don't even know how I would research this, but I'm willing to bet that was at least something that Russian spies believed that they could do if they just tried hard enough.
Mm.
Everything interesting in this novel usually comes down to actual reality, which is the weirdest thing.
Yeah, and it's definitely worthwhile checking out the afterword in the book where he talks about, you know, here are the guardrails I put on myself to do this.
Yeah.
I'm very impressed with it as a novel and just as a piece of fiction. In general, right? As a science fiction or fantasy.
Both.
It works well that way. It works well as a spy novel. Very cool.
I would agree. All around, really impressive novel, and I would heartily recommend it to everyone.
Nice. Yeah, me too. And it's, I mean, like you said when you were trying to come up with comps, right? Nope, I haven't read anything like this. And so so I want to thank you for recommending it, because it really was a unique one.
Yeah. I hope that, you know, I mean, there's several other power, you know, you'll have to get to Anubis Gates, you'll have to get to Deviant's Palace, and you'll have to do Last Call at the very least.
Okay.
Those are all award winners on your list. So.
Oh, excellent. All right. Well, more Tim Powers in the future for me. And, you know, based on this one, I look forward to it.
Yeah.
So I think that'll probably suffice for final thoughts.
Yeah.
Can people find you anywhere?
I guess if you wait about a month, you can find me on the Western Colorado University faculty stuff. There's two Paul Williams there, so... make sure you email the more handsome one who is in the English department, not the computer science guy.
Nice. That sounds good. Well, you know, we've had computer science guys on the podcast before, so it's nice to have somebody who knows what they're talking about from a literature standpoint. I'm just a hobbyist. So,
hey, you do very well. You do a good job, Seth.
Thanks, man. All right. Well, Paul, thanks again. And I'm sure we'll interact down the line, and congratulations on your soon to be doctorate.
Thank you.
All right. Bye. The theme music for the Who Goes There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kusky.